This is VOA News. I'm Marissa Melton. AP sources say State Department officials were told in May that Ukraine's president was feeling pressured by U.S. officials. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has more.
At a joint news conference with President Donald Trump in September, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed their July call that is now central to the impeachment proceedings against Trump.
I think, and you read it, that nobody pushed me. Yes.
In other words, no pressure.
But two people with knowledge of the matter tell the Associated Press in May, officials at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv were told Zelensky was seeking advice on how to deal with pressure from U.S. officials to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. The information came from Amos Hochstein, an American businessman and former diplomat who attended a meeting on May 7th with Zelensky. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The Trump administration is abandoning a 40-year-old U.S. policy that declared Israeli Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank inconsistent with international law. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the move on Monday.
The Trump administration is reversing the Obama administration's approach towards Israeli settlements. U.S. public statements on settlement activities in the West Bank have been inconsistent over decades.
Pompeo said Monday's reversal does not mean the United States is making up its mind at this time about the status of the West Bank, saying that question is part of a final peace deal. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcomed the U.S. announcement, while Palestinian officials called the U.S. move irresponsible behavior that contradicts totally with international law. North Korea is responding to a tweet by President Trump that hinted at another summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Pyongyang says it has no interest in giving Mr. Trump further meetings to brag about unless it gets something in return. This is VOA News. Iranian state media says Iran's Revolutionary Guard is warning anti-government protesters of decisive action if unrest over gasoline price hikes continues. Protests have spread across the country since Friday. There's been a delay in the battle over President Trump's taxes. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
Chief Justice John Roberts is ordering an indefinite delay in the House of Representatives' demand for President Trump's financial records. That gives the Supreme Court time to figure out how to handle the high-stakes dispute. The order contained no hint about what the court ultimately will do. The delay could last a matter of days or weeks if the court is willing to let an appeals court ruling in favor of the House remain in place without granting full review of the case. But the delay could extend for months if the justices decide they need to hear arguments and issue a written opinion. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Protesters have once again blocked the entrance to Iraq's port near Basra. Reuters' Emily Spickle has more.
Protesters have once again blocked the entrance to Iraq's Umm Qasr commodities port near Basra. The standoff is preventing employees and tankers from entering and has brought operations down by 50%. One source told Reuters if it continues, operations will come to a complete halt by the end of the day. Since anti-government protests began early October, the port has been blocked twice before. But protesters who are demanding the overthrow of a political class seen as corrupt and beholden to foreign interests have shown no sign of backing down, despite the fact more than 300 people have been killed around the country since the unrest began.
That's Reuters' Emily Spickle reporting. Ukraine's military is confirming that Russia is returning three Ukrainian naval ships that it captured a year ago. Reuters' Francis McGuire reports.
Ukraine's military has confirmed that Russia is returning three Ukrainian naval ships it captured last year. The vessels were seized in the Kerch Strait in November 2018. Two gunboats and a tugboat were taken in the narrow strip of water between mainland Russia and Crimea. Ukraine has pushed for their return as a goodwill gesture from Russia ahead of a four-way peace summit on eastern Ukraine next month in Paris. Russia and Ukraine will be joined by France and Germany in the talks.
Reuters' Francis McGuire reporting. The United States is expressing grave concern at the unrest in Hong Kong after tensions escalated between police and protesters over the weekend. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Monday that the Hong Kong government bears primary responsibility for bringing calm to Hong Kong, calling violence on either side unacceptable. In the past few days, Hong Kong police have threatened to fire live bullets if demonstrators did not stop using weapons during protests. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union joins forces with the WHO to boost health in Africa.
The current Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is a stark reminder that many AU countries are vulnerable to the impact of epidemics.
That's World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. South Africa's Democratic Alliance Party new leader will work for stability ahead of the party congress. A Kenyan activist welcomes U.S. travel ban on former Attorney General Amos Weko for alleged corruption. And Uganda's Bobby Wine sees music as a tool for political revolution.
Like it was in Nigeria in the times of Fela Kuti, like it is in Uganda in our own current times, music is supposed to be used for revolution. And that is one important lesson that I took from Fela.
Human Rights Watch says Sudanese security forces planned their attacks on protesters. And Nigeria's crackdown on border smuggling is said to be affecting regional trade. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Health Organization and African Union have pledged to join forces to work towards universal health coverage on the continent. The pledge grows out of the Addis Ababa Call to Action, a recent agreement among AU countries to increase domestic investment in health. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
At a special signing ceremony, the heads of the World Health Organization and African Union Commission committed themselves to making significant investments to improve the health of over a billion Africans. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the memorandum of understanding he signed with the AU formalizes their cooperation in three key areas. He says they pledge to support the African Medicines Agency so people on the continent will have access to high-quality, safe, and effective medicines. The WHO and AU also have agreed to strengthen their collaboration with the African Center for Disease Control, with a particular focus on emergency preparedness.
The current Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is a stark reminder that many AU countries are vulnerable to the impact of epidemics. For too long, the world has invested in panic rather than preparedness. We throw money at an outbreak, and when it's finished, we do nothing to prevent the next one.
The third key element, he says, is to implement the agreement on universal health coverage. That will take money. So he says WHO will work with government health and finance ministers to develop strong financing models. He says investing in primary health clinics is one of the best ways of promoting health. The chairman of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki Mohamed, calls the MOU a concrete move toward improving health in Africa.
Et pour l'Afrique, c'est une nouvelle page qui s'ouvre.
He says this agreement has opened a new page for Africa. This newly minted partnership, he says, will enhance the possibilities of achieving health for all on the continent. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The spokesperson for South Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance Party says newly elected interim leader John Steenhuisen will seek to ensure the party's stability before its upcoming Congress in May next year. Sally Malatsi dismissed concerns that the election of Steenhuisen, who happens to be white, will make it difficult for the party to attract blacks. Steenhuisen's election over the weekend came after Musi Maimane, the black leader of the party, resigned, saying it was difficult to make the party attractive to the black population. Democratic Alliance spokesperson Sally Malatsi spoke to viewers Peter Clotty about Steenhuisen's election.
John Steenhuisen, many would remember, that he was the chief whip of the Democratic Alliance in Parliament up until over a month ago, where he assumed the role of the parliamentary leader of the Democratic Alliance, again filling a position that became vacant when Musi Maimane stepped down as the party. He has a long history of leadership positions in different structures of the Democratic Alliance. He has served as a councillor and the chief whip in the Durban municipality and ultimately served in the KwaZulu-Natal provincial legislature until he became to parliament over 8 years ago.
What does your new interim leader bring to the table in terms of advocating or leading the party?
The primary task of the interim leader now is to ensure that there is stability in the organization. The party did resolve over a month ago that we will have a fully fledged Congress as early as May next year. So he will be the interim leader in this transition as we go towards the full Congress. But it is to ensure that there is stability in the organization, that we refocus on presenting an alternative offer rooted in our liberal democratic values that have always underpinned our political philosophy as an organization.
Will he be able to fill the void following the abrupt stepping down of the former leader, Masimani, and some top-level officials who are seen as stalwarts within the party, advocating for the party to attract more South Africans? Will he be able to heal the rift in the party?
Well, we have absolute confidence in Mr. Steenhuisen's capacity and abilities to lead the organization through this difficult phase and ultimately to lead the organization towards being an attractive political home for many South Africans who share our underpinned in their liberal democratic values, informed by the need to build an inclusive society and to tackle poverty, which continues to entrap many poor South Africans.
Talking about inclusivity, some analysts said that the stepping down of Masimane, the former leader of the DA, could make the party unattractive to disgruntled supporters of the ruling African National Congress Party. What is your take, and do you think their assessment is justified?
Well, the assessment is largely hyperventilated and presents a misreading of the political mood in the country, but also of the state of the organization. The Democratic Alliance has sufficient diverse depth of leadership in the organization that would continue to push to attract the votes that we need to first be an appealing home for all South Africans so that we can present a strong challenge to ultimately wrestle the ANC out of power.
Solly Malatsi is the spokesperson for South Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Johannesburg. Zimbabwe Finance Minister Mthule Mbe has presented the 2020 budget, saying it will lead the country from economic decline towards its vision of becoming a middle-income nation by 2030. Kuzai Navashe has details.
Speaking at a budget review, Central Bank Governor John Mangujka said what remains is to fully implement the budget.
The budget has been presented. What's now left is to walk the talk. What I've noticed in this country is that walking the talk is more difficult than talking. We've spoken quite a lot in this country. We've made plans, and those plans, they've not come to fruition. The budget has laid down the groundwork for youth, for women, for exporters, for everyone.
The minister has said the government is winding down on austerity measures, which have subjected Zimbabweans to heavy taxes in the past year. Chris Chenga is an economist, and he probes if the budget really winds down on austerity measures.
Zimbabwe seems to be winding down on austerity, if it was really on an austerity path, because it's very different to tell with the currency distortions that came about. I would say this is a transitional regime. So to say that it's been really doing austerity while you're changing your monetary policy, it's not 100% accurate.
Cheng, however, says the budget is promising.
It's definitely an interesting budget, and one very different from the prior 5 years of government spending, in the sense that they're targeting to reduce the fiscal deficit and get it under 5% of GDP, which they highlight as also being the regional standard. It's a very liberal budget, which is trying to remove a lot of fiscal responsibility from central government and trying to attract private sector investment.
The budget is invested in youth employment through an entrepreneurship program, along with incentives for companies to employ youthful employees. Peter Mutasa is president of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. He says the budget doesn't prioritize the poor.
If we are to come to the substantive issues in the budget, with respect, on behalf of labor, we say that there's nothing much for workers and for the poor citizens in the budget. If we are to be frank, it's not pro-poor in many respects. It can only be poor when we test it. We have to test it on our tables. We have to feel it. Currently, we can't even buy bread. We can't buy shoes. We can't pay school fees. We can't pay rentals.
Critics say the budget, which was presented Thursday, focuses on growth with targets of 4.7% growth in mining and 5% growth in the agricultural sector, despite drought threats as climate change takes its toll. Many are anxious to see if this is the budget that will steer Zimbabwe back to its yesteryears, where the cost of living was within reach for the majority. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinamashe from Harare.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 19. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Ugandan musician and legislator Robert Chakulai, better known as Bobi Wine, has been named one of Time magazine's 100 Young Rising Stars, but he worries about efforts to sideline him. Bobi Wine recently announced he plans to run for president in 2021. Wine tells viewers Jackson Vuganyi he worries that longtime President Yoweri Museveni's government is already using the country's security apparatus to go after members of his People Power movement.
In less than 2 years, Ugandans will head to the polls in an election that many say will decide the country's political future for years to come. Opposition parties in Uganda are preparing for 2021, already casting it as a generational battle. Uganda's longtime president, Yoweri Museveni, will be facing many challenges, including Bobi Wine, a popular artist and member of parliament who was only 4 years old when Museveni took power 33 years ago. However, Bobi Wine is worried that as the election season draws close, President Museveni's government has increased pressure on his grassroots People Power movement, using the country's security apparatus to go after members of the organization.
We know that it's going to get worse. President Museveni is known to use violence, and indeed we project that it's going to unleash a lot of violence on the people of Uganda.
Bobi Wine was recently named as one of Time magazine's 100 Young Rising Stars who are impacting the future of politics and science in the world. Even long before he joined politics, he used his music as a driver and centerpiece in his activism. He says that he draws inspiration from some of Africa's legendary artists like Fela Kuti.
Fela continuously inspires us to stand up against brutal regimes. He lived in times that I could only compare to the times we're living in Uganda. He taught us that music is not for only pleasure, especially where there is injustice. Where there's injustice, like it was in Nigeria in the times of Fela Kuti, like it is in Uganda in our own current times, music is supposed to be used for revolution. And that is one important lesson that I took from Fela and will teach the generations that will come after me.
Analysts say that Bobi Wine's effective use of music to communicate his message could explain why the Ugandan government has of late barred him from performing to his fans. But that has not stopped him from releasing new music, like his latest viral hit.
The new song that we have is called Kasukari. That song, we did it to communicate to the people. I mean, in the past, we never used to be taken seriously as ghetto people. We were dismissed as hooligans, as, vagabond. But recently, you see that President Museveni and his henchmen are actually picking so much interest in the ghetto because they know that the people of the ghetto have spoken through their child.
Currently on tour in North America, where he is meeting diaspora supporters of his grassroots Power People movement, Bobi Wine says that he will continue to use his music to expose social injustice and to mobilize community activism ahead of the 2021 elections in Uganda. For Voice of America, I'm Jackson Vunganyi.
A leading Kenyan activist says he welcomes a U.S. travel ban on former Kenyan Attorney General Amos Weko for alleged corruption. Okiya Mtata, however, says Weko, currently a member of the Kenyan Senate, should be given the chance to legally face his accusers. His remarks came after U.S. Secretary of State Michael Pompeo released a statement imposing a travel ban on Senator Amos Weko. According to U.S. regulation, the ban also affects Weko's wife, Flora Ngaira, and his son Julius Weko. The former attorney general is accused of significant corruption in Kenya. Activist Okiya Mtata spoke with viewer Peter Clotty about the U.S. travel ban.
Any effort towards fighting corruption is welcome. And Mr. Weko is accused of very, very serious crime of corruption, whereby if you look at what he was there when the WikiLeaks happened, he was among the people the then ambassador of the United States, Reinberger, had isolated as a person who had, using his status as attorney general, had interfered with the political and judicial processes to his personal benefit as the detriment of public policy, including the interests of the United States of America. So I don't know that the basis upon which he has been banned, but all the same, the ban is a very, very heavy statement on the country, and I think it should serve as a warning to other public officials to think about tomorrow.
With this ban that has been placed on the former attorney general, who is also a senator, by the way, what impact will it have on Kenyan government officials in perhaps engaging in acts of corruption?
I think what the United States is doing is basically signaling that there's need for action. What will be more devastating with the domestic law to take action and maybe hold these people accountable for the devastation of the Kenyan economy, which we are all feeling. But all said and done, I think it's a very, very welcome move, and I think it's a warning to others who may want to be corrupt or who have been corrupt to know that there is international law and there is also local law. They may be able to suppress local law, but international law has a way of catching up with them in situations that we live in during the current world order. And so I think that that ban for me is a welcome development, and we want to see more of that so that these people do not just walk around like being powerful and being successful, yet they are basically thieves.
What impact do you think this will have on the work of the former attorney general, who is a senator, by the way?
Ideally, he should resign from his position as senator and other public engagements, because this second indictment really, on one head, will not allow one to perform his public functions.
Okiya Mtata is a Kenyan activist. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. Human Rights Watch says attacks by some Sudanese security forces on protesters in early June were planned and therefore could amount to crimes against humanity. In a report released on Monday, the group calls on Sudan's transitional authorities to arrest security forces who attacked protesters with deadly force since December. As Michael Atit reports from Khartoum, credible sources said more than 100 people were killed by security forces during the protests.
The 59-page report documents how Sudanese security forces in Khartoum attacked protesters during the massive sit-in on June 3rd and in the days that followed in other neighborhoods of the capital, as well as the neighborhood of Bahri and Omdurman. Jehan Henry, Associate Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, says her organization documented several attacks on protesters leading up to the June 3rd crackdown and the subsequent attack on protesters on June 30th in Omdurman.
They shot unarmed protesters and killed them on the spot. They also rounded up protesters and beat them, cut their hair, insulted them, and held them arbitrarily in detention for periods of time before releasing them. We also documented many cases of rape and other sexual assaults.
The report says credible sources estimated that at least 120 people were killed on June 3rd and following days. Hundreds were injured and dozens more missing. Henry says many Sudanese families told a Human Rights Watch team that their loved ones are still missing. She says many people are calling for a transparent investigation and want the perpetrators held accountable, including those who might be holding high position in the transitional government.
The crimes that were committed in this context could be crimes against humanity because it appears that they were planned in advance and they're part of a systematic attack on protesters that Sudanese security forces have carried out since December. The method of cracking down on protesters has included live ammunition, so shooting to kill, shooting dead the protesters.
Henry says Sudan's transitional government should ensure that all investigations are independent, transparent, and conform to international standards. She suggests that The new investigation committee formed last September by Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok could seek assistance from experts with the African Union, the United Nations, or the recognized entities. Repeated calls to the head of the recent appointed investigation committee, Nabil Adib, and the spokesperson for the Sovereign Council, Muhammad Al-Faki, for comment on this story went unanswered. For VOA News, I am Michael Atid in Khartoum.
Nigeria's decision to shut down land border trade in an effort to stop smuggling is affecting the prices of goods that are being shipped through already bogged down water ports. Nigeria's neighbors say the ban is against the principles of free trade, but Nigerian rice farmers welcome what they see as support for a local industry. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Emeka Ugwoke, like many Nigerian rice dealers, imports overland from neighboring Benin and often through informal channels. But since the Nigerian government closed down border trade August in a bid to crack down on smuggling, his orders have been stuck in Benin and rice prices have shot up, he says. Since I started this rice business this year is the worst because the border trade has affected many of our goods. The price of a bag of rice has increased by almost 70%. Nigeria's trade channels remain open through water ports, but they remain clogged by poor infrastructure, bureaucracy, and corruption. Nigeria's neighbors complain the suspension of border trade flies against the spirit of the African Continental Free Trade Area deal that Abuja signed in July. But authorities insist that most border trade is illegal. Spokesperson of the Nigerian Customs Services, Joseph Atta, says at least $8 million worth of smuggled goods have been seized so far.
It's yielding so much positive results in terms of security situation improvement. There's been very, very tremendous positive improvement on the side of security. And then economic activities have been stimulated. Our farmers are smiling to the banks. The patronage has shifted inward.
Resting Tedike, an ex-oil militant and rice farmer benefiting from the closed border, wants the border to remain closed.
Let's put it blunt out there. The federal government should keep the borders shut. If you don't see foreign rice shop, what are you going to do? You're going to look within.
But economists like Ken Ife warn the trade limit should not be permanent.
And we need to promote trade. We need to liberalize trade. But it has to be done in such a way that they will promote employment, that will promote incipient growth and inclusive growth in our economies, but not undermine and destroy the trading relations.
Apart from impact on trade relations, rice trader Ugwoke says as long as border trade is banned, customers are losing out also on quality, as standards of cheaper local rice are not as high as imports.
Some local rice.
Our customers complain that the local rice contains stones and sand particles. And honestly, I have opened some of them and confirmed it, he says. Although Nigeria plans to reopen its border trade by January if its neighbors halt the smuggling, some lawmakers are pushing for a 2-year extension. If that happens, Nigeria will face growing pressure from its neighbors over free trade, as well as from Nigeria's millions of rice consumers. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The World Health Organization and the African Union have pledged to join forces to work towards universal health coverage on the continent. The pledge grows out of the Addis Ababa Call to Action, a recent agreement among AU countries to increase domestic investment in health. And that is it for this Tuesday, November 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the fall of the Berlin Wall 30 years ago marked the end of the Cold War and brought about a number of significant changes in Africa. We'll take a closer look on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat.
African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.